Well, good morning. I don't know if this is a good spot or an unenviable spot on the program. I've been to programs and been the first speaker when everybody was half asleep and or not there. And I've been on just before lunch when they couldn't wait for me to get through because they wanted to eat lunch. And then I've been on after lunch when they couldn't stay awake. But this is the first time I've ever been dead last. So this is a new experience. We're going to talk about the barren fig tree. To me, it's one of the most powerful parables, the one that perhaps has as much meaning to me as any one. And I'm glad I got this one. I hope I can do it halfway justice. Avoiding the tickle. That will be evident in just a minute. I'm going to give you three questions we'll talk about at the end of the lesson. Does God still look for fruit from His people? Is He looking at me now? And is it too late for me to be productive? So let's get right on into the parable. Jesus used the fig tree to teach great truths. There'll be a judgment for all. This is Luke 13, chapter, verses 6 and 7. He spoke also this parable. A certain man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard. He came and sought fruit thereon and found none. Then said he unto the dresser of his vineyard, Behold, these 3 years I come seeking fruit on this fig tree and find none. Cut it down. Why cumbers it the ground? Well, let's back up just a minute and pick up a few points. Notice it was a fig tree. It was the right kind of tree planted in the right place. Right? He came there to seek fruit. That's the whole purpose of planting the tree. He didn't plant the tree as an ornamental. He didn't plant it for a shade. He planted it to get fruit off of it. It was meant to produce. It was left there to produce. It says he came 3 years. Now, some have found a significance in the term 3 years, that this was referring to the nation of Israel, which it could be. And the 3 years could have been the 3 years prior of Jesus' ministry. And then he was going to have one more year that Jesus would be there. That could be true. It could not be true. But the term 3 years serves the purpose, even if it doesn't apply to 3 years of earthly ministry, because it tells us that for 3 years this man thought this tree was big enough that it should have had fruit. He came back 3 times, 3 separate years already, looking for fruit, and he hadn't found any. He was going to give it. He's ready to cut it down now. He's going to cut it down because it cumbers the ground. It's taking up space. It's not killing the soil. It's just taking up space that something else could be productive there. All right? Now we read about the good part, a second chance. Verses 8 and 9. He answering said unto him, Lord, let it alone this year also, till I shall dig about it and dung it. And if it bear fruit, well. And if not, then after that you shall cut it down. So let's notice one more year. Leave it alone. Leave it to itself and see what it will do. But, I'm going to dig about it and I'm going to dung it. I'm going to do something to get its attention. I'm going to shock it. I'm going to wake it up. I'm going to make it move. Okay, for the rest of this lesson, I'm going to try to present ideas to you. And they're ideas to make us move. Not to continue the status quo, keep doing things like we've always done it. But this parable is a parable about change. And there's an old saying about change. Nothing changes until something moves. So something has got to cause a move to make a change. This parable is about change. He's going to dig about it and dung it. If it bears fruit, that's great. It's doing what it was supposed to do. But if not, then it will be cut down. So we'll see what that might mean after a while. What this parable reveals to me, this parable reveals that God is watching us now. You know, sometimes people think, well, I'm getting ready for the judgment. Now, yeah, you are. But you're being judged right now. God is judging us now. And He's judging us against our potential. What we could do. what we could be doing, the lessons we could be giving, the amount of study we could be doing, the things we could write, the people we could visit, the potential we've got now. There is an end to idleness if we would be saved. If we would be saved, we've got to realize we've got to stop being idle. Jesus is willing to invest more time in us. The keeper of the vineyard said, "Give me another year till I dig about it and dung it." But we still have the chance to fail even after divine intervention. Even after another year, even after the digging and the dunging, the tree still had to produce. If it produces, well. If not, we're going to cut it down next year. This was not the first judgment of living people we have recorded. Belshazzar saw the handwriting on the wall. Now notice what Daniel said as he interpreted the four words. This is the writing that was written. Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. Okay? This is the interpretation of the thing. Mene meant God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tekel, which is from our title, the most scary words that you can almost read in the Bible. Because this was given to a man that was still alive. You are weighed in the balances and you have been found wanting. Judgment is now. We're being looked at now to see if we're fruitful. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. We do not want this judgment against us, but we're being weighed right now. We all have a maximum potential, and that maximum potential is the best we can do. Now, if we look back at our past life, how many of us would say that we have done the very best we could do all of our lives? I couldn't say that. But what are we doing from here on out? What is our attitude? Is our attitude to be no better than the best that we've been, that we admit we weren't as best as we could have been? Or are we just going to keep going the way we have been going? Or is there a little room for improvement? Is there a few more minutes we could spend here? Is there something we could cut out of our lives there that's really not necessary to give us more time to show God that we're trying to reach that potential? There is just so much time. Hebrews 5, 12 through 14. For when for the time you ought to be teachers. It's a scary thought. God knows how much time it takes us to get ready to teach. And He says, you ought to have already been a teacher. You have need that one teach you again, which be the first principles of the oracles of God. And are become such as have need of milk and not of strong meat. Everyone that uses milk is unskillful in the word of righteousness. For he is a babe, and as a babe he must grow. But strong meat belongs to them that are of full age, even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. Do you study? Do you study to be prepared, or do you wait for a crisis to study? If a marriage question came up in your church, are you already mentally and spiritually and scripturally prepared to fully answer that question? Or are you going to wait until there's a marriage crisis in your church and then you're going to take time to study to be ready? And it could be about any number of other things that could come up in the church or come up with a church member. Are we going to wait till there's a crisis to get ready? Or are we going to study now so that we'll be ready when the time comes to face the crisis? Meeting our maximum potential cannot be faked. 2 Timothy 3, 1 through 5. This know also that in the last days perilous times shall come. For men shall be lovers of their own selves, having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. From such turn away. They're trying to fake it. They have the form of godliness. They'll show up at church at the right times, but it doesn't translate on into the other hours of their lives during the week. Different potentials are no excuse. We hadn't really picked up this parable yet. This is the parable of the man traveling into a far country. Parable of the talents. He gave one man five talents, another two, another one, to every man according to his several ability. Then he took his journey. When he came back, he asked the servants what they had done. He that had received five talents made them other five talents. He that had received two gained other two. He that had received one dug in the earth and hid his Lord's money. The good man, or the master, told the one talent man, "You ought therefore to have put my money to the exchangers, and then at my coming I should have received my own with usury. Cast you the unprofitable or the unproductive servant into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth." It doesn't matter that I do not have a photographic memory that can memorize verse after verse after verse like James McDonald and some of these other speakers. I envy that, because he says he can read the verse one time and he's got it, chapter and verse. He can come back and just bring it back up in a lesson. I cannot do that. So do I not try to do what I can do because I can't do what he can do? What about the two-talent man? Was he condemned because he didn't produce five talents? No. He was commended because apparently he did the best he could with what the master had given him. But notice, the master knew their potential. He gave the five-talent man five talents, the two-talent man two, the one-talent man one, but then the one-talent man was unproductive. He didn't use his talent. Our maximum potential will never be reached with misconceptions. Titus says, in Titus just recorded, there are many unruly and vain talkers and deceivers. Misconception. Especially they of the circumcision, whose mouths must be stopped, who subvert whole houses. Okay, we're talking about two different classes of people that are operating under a misconception. One is the teacher. The other one is the house that falls for it. You know, I could come up here, or someone else could come up here and give you a false doctrine. And that's partly on me for doing that. But then it's also on you for not being smart enough to recognize me as a false teacher. So it lies both ways. We have to be prepared for both things. Teaching which things they ought not, for filthy lucre's sake, they profess that they know God, but in works they deny Him. See, the fruit denies the tree. Being abominable, disobedient, none to every good work, reprobate. Now that last word is an interesting word. It's going to come up right at the end of the lesson. Reprobate is a word which refers back, one of the first uses of the word, I understand it, in the Old Testament. It referred to money that was not pure, like silver coin that wasn't pure silver, or gold coin that wasn't pure gold. It involves mixed materials. So let's get into digging and dunging. You know, having an agricultural background, that phrase always just kind of stuck in my mind. Digging and dunging, digging and dunging. We know what the digging is, do we? To dig in agricultural terms means to remove weeds and competition for nutrients. To loosen the soil for rain and nutrients to get to the roots. Loosen the competition. To dung, we would use the word fertilize, but they use dung. They use waste of animals and whatever else they could find as fertilizer. But we would say we were going to fertilize something. We're going to use Miracle-Gro. That's neater. But they would have used dung. So dung was to provide food for the plants, that which provides for health and growth and fruit. And so what I'm thinking is, the keeper of the vineyard is saying, I'm going to dig and remove competition, then I'm going to dung to make sure the nutrients are there for the right kind of growth. So let's see what this could be. Before dunging can work, the weeds must be dug. Weeds take up the most invaluable nutrient that you've got, and that's time. Time is the most invaluable. It's priceless. There's no price you can put on the time we have. And weeds take it up. Hebrews said in Hebrews, "Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us." The weight. What does the weight do? It takes up our nutrients, our nutrient of time. Weeds use up our mental energy. Now, I'm going to spend a few minutes on something kind of strange right here, but it's something I think we need to learn to practice. We need to control our wandering eyes and focus on what's really important. Only look to the point of recognition, whether it's men looking at cars or men looking at women or women looking at HGTV or QVC or whatever we spend time looking at. We've got to learn to only look to the point of recognition. All right, let me look at the next thing and we'll talk about this. The point of recognition. Learn not to gaze. There's a difference between looking and gazing. If you look at something, you look at it long enough till you recognize what it is. But if you gaze, you get to the point of mental participation. What did Jesus say about adultery? If you look at a woman to lust after her, you have committed adultery with her in your heart. If you look past the point of recognition, I mean, men, listen, this is graphic, but if we're going down the street and all of a sudden we glance to the right and we see a woman over there walking to a swimming pool and she's got on a thong and that's it, we don't need to turn our head the second time to look. The first time we look, we saw what it was. Then we need to look ahead, see? We're looking. If we turn and look the second time, we're gazing. And if we're not careful, we're going to mentally participate in something we don't need to be mentally participating in. And look, you ladies got the same thing. How many of you have got Southern Living and this magazine and that magazine, and you look and you gaze and you look at HGTV and everything everybody else has got is better than what I've got? See, it gets us all. We need to learn to look at the point of recognition, and if it's something we don't need to spend our time looking at, we need to get back and focus on what we're supposed to be spending our time looking at. Remember the 10th commandment. All right, has everybody got it? Y'all remember what the 10th commandment was? Thou shalt not covet. And then he went on to say what? Everything your neighbor's got. Don't covet his wife. Don't covet his donkeys. Don't covet his house. Don't covet his money. Do not covet. And here is where the devil puts the weeds in our soul that keeps us from being productive. Thou shalt not covet. So how are we going to dig up the time wasters? We're going to dig now. Titus tells us, but avoid foolish questions, see? Avoid foolish questions, genealogies, and contentions, and strivings about the law, for they are unprofitable and vain. They're time wasters. I've had people ask me questions. They were hard questions. And sometimes I spend time on the questions, and sometimes I just kind of put them off to the side because they're like endless questions. Well, what do you think about this person in the Old Testament? Well, I don't know. I could research and spend 10 hours reading about it, but it's not going to make any difference to me or you. So why would I spend that time on something that's unproductive and unfruitful and vain? This is going to be a touchy subject now. Unprofitable relationships are things that are time wasters in our life as far as productivity goes. I didn't write this. This is in the Scriptures. Jesus Christ gave us this. He that loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He that loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. There are people that worship their parents. There are parents that worship their children. This is unproductive. We're supposed to love them. We're supposed to honor them. We're supposed to show them tough love. We're supposed to discipline them. We're supposed to provide for them. We're supposed to keep them safe. But we are not supposed to worship them. Are we? Where does it say we're supposed to worship certain members of our family? And yet if we do, what does it do? It takes up time. It takes up resources. It takes up things we can do to prepare ourselves to be fruitful. And eventually, it takes away from them being fruitful too. If we tie ourselves to them so much that they can't develop. Well, what about carnal identities? We got to dig these up because they make us unproductive. Corinthians, Paul said, "For you are yet carnal," which means really worldly. "For whereas there is among you envying, strife, and divisions, are you not carnal and walk as men? For while one says," these three words so important, "I am of Paul," and another says, "I am of Apollos," are you not carnal? I am of. If someone gets up and talks with you in a conversation, are you more likely to say, "I'm a Christian," or are you more likely to say, "I am an Alabama football fan," or "I am a Georgia football fan," or some other team? Are you more likely to bring up the fact that you are a Christian or that you pull for a certain team? Because that will lead to a more fun conversation. Dig up the carnal traditions, the things and the ways we've always done it. In Peter says, "Wherefore laying aside, dig them up, five qualities, which could be family traditions, malice, guile, hypocrisies, envies, and all evil speakings. As newborn babes desire the sincere milk of the word." Now, why do I say those are family traditions? Because if you see a person, or if it may have been you, that your feelings and your thinkings about other people when you get crossed up was malice, which is very ill will, guile, which is deceit, hypocrisies, saying one thing and doing another, envying and evil speakings. If you had those in your life, chances are you got that from your mom or your daddy. You grew up in a household where those things were practiced. And even though they didn't set you down and teach you, you picked it up by osmosis, that negative feeling, that negativism, that always looking at things on the bad side. You lived in it, you grew up with it, and you developed it. And it's something they gave you, not meaning to, but you picked it up as a trait and a quality. It became a family tradition. If you're not careful, if you don't dig it out of your life, you're going to pass it on to your kids. Malice, guile, hypocrisy, envy, and all evil speakings. We've got to get those out of our life because they ruin our productivity. Well, what about the carnal pastimes? Galatians, Paul said, "Let us not be desirous of vainglory, provoking one another, envying one another." Some people just sit around and this is what they do. They talk about this stuff. They envy one another. They try to find ways for vain glory. Except they don't think it's vain, but Paul said it was vain. So let's move on to another idea. Now this one, I hope I don't do such a terrible job getting this across. This is just my idea, okay? Because this is a parable about change. And unless something moves, nothing changes. For dunging to work, there must be awe. Now, this is really not my idea. I saw this a few months ago. It was talking about people traveling. And it says that people need to travel to places to see sights they've never seen. Magnificent places like the Grand Canyon or the mountains or just something that's bigger than we are. So that they can feel a sense of awe. To feel how little we are. To see how great the world is. Well, I thought that was sort of strange, but I did think about it. And it did sort of make sense. And so I thought about that in this lesson. The keeper was going to dig and dung the plant to shock the plant that had sat there 3 years without producing fruit. And he's got to do something to it to shock it, to make it produce fruit, or else it's going to be cut down. Okay? What better than something that could happen to create a sense of awe? Now, the danger in me presenting this is there are people that live their life waiting on God to give them a call. It could be a voice they hear when they're out behind the barn or something. And they're waiting on that call to get serious about serving the Lord. That's the danger. But I'm going to remove that danger, because what I want to get across to you is God, I believe, is giving us all the time. Okay? Awe is an overwhelming feeling of reverence, admiration, fear, etc., produced by that which is grand, sublime, extremely powerful, or the like. Okay? It could be a lightning strike. I worked with a guy one time that told me he was going down the road, and he asked me, "Do you remember this little stretch of road?" And I said, "Yeah, because I traveled it too." He said, "You remember that big dead tree that was sitting there right by the side of the road?" I said, "I remember that tree." He said, "You remember the other day we were riding down this road, and I was ahead of you," and he was on ahead of me, and he said, "Just as I got to that tree, lightning struck that tree." He said, "That tree exploded." He said, "It blew all over the road. It blew all over my truck, scared me to death." And the next thing he said was, "Are you a Christian?" Well, yeah. But see what had happened to him? He had been brought to a sense of awe. He had been brought to a sense that there was something bigger than he was that he in no way could control. Was that lightning strike? But it doesn't have to be a lightning strike. God doesn't have to nearly kill us if we will pay attention. It could be in a small flower. A small flower. I can't explain a small flower. A small flower puts me in awe. I've got a granddaughter that doesn't see real well. And when she has to look for something, she gets right down on it, right next to it to see. And she likes to get flowers for her mother. And she won't be out here picking a rose or something else. We'll see her out in the yard walking along. "Hattie, come on, what are you doing?" "I'm looking for a flower for mommy." And she's down with her eye that she can see good, partly good at with, right on the ground, looking and looking, taking those little fingers. And she'll come up with a flower, a bloom of a weed, be no bigger than my little finger. And she is so proud of that. She wants to take that to her mother. See, that is special to her. And I can't even explain that little flower. So if we are, what I'm saying is, if we are attentive, there are things all around us that create this sense of awe. If we are attentive to it, it could be in four words in a still small voice from a face in a mirror. "I died for you." That could do it. It will. It can. "I died for you." Sometimes we have to read between the lines, though. Paul said this in Romans, "For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen." Huh? Is that wording right? "From the invisible things are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." And in Hebrews he said, "Through faith we understand the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that things which are seen were not made of things which do appear." We have to read between the lines. Yes, God made the world, and it's marvelous. And that same power that made the world is going to judge us and can make us productive. We must be in tune with our spiritual mind, not our carnal. Paul said in Romans, "For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace." Because the carnal mind is enmity against God, it is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be. So why would we even talk about all this? Because the closer we get to God, the happier we're going to be. And I want you to be happy. I don't want you to be scared. I don't want you to be questioning. I want you to be trying. And I want you to be happy. That's what God wants you to be. To be carnally minded is death, because everything in the world is going to die. To be spiritually minded is life and peace. And that's what we want to pass on to our children. And that's the kind of household we want to have. It's a peaceful household. Okay, dunging is necessary to provide nutrients for growth and for fruit. Let's look at the word grow. We grow to our maximum potential. Okay, I know I'll admit that I haven't been as good as I could have been. So am I going to snap my fingers and be great? No. You're going to have to grow. See, the fig tree is going to have to grow. We grow to our maximum potential. In Philippians, Paul said, "This I pray, that your love may abound yet more and more." It's a process. The growth of the fig tree was going to be a process. It's a process for us. "Your love may abound yet more and more, knowledge and all judgment, that you may approve things that are excellent." That's a good start. "That you may be sincere and without offense till the day of Christ." That's part of it. "Being filled with the fruits of righteousness, which are by Jesus Christ, unto the glory and praise of God." Okay, did you think, when we start talking about this, that we're talking about that what you need to do is you need to go out here and start a church somewhere? Or that you need to go out and save 1,000 people this next year? That's your fruit? Well, that's pretty good. That would be the result of your fruit. But what about individual improvement? We must improve ourselves individually, which is something we can do. Filled with the fruits. That could be us, our lives, individually. The Thessalonians, Paul said, "Furthermore, then we beseech you, brethren, and exhort you by the Lord Jesus Christ, as you have received of us, how you ought to walk and please God, so you would abound more and more." It's a process. It's growth. It's a growth process. "But we beseech you, brethren, that you increase more and more, that you study to be quiet and to do your own business, and to work with your own hands as we commanded you, that you may walk honestly toward them that are without, and that you may have lack of nothing." I want you to have a lack of nothing. But if you're carnally minded, I can't help you. I don't have enough money to help you have a lack of nothing if you are carnally minded. But if you're spiritually minded, we can read in the Bible together and find wonderful food and nutrients, dung, if you will, that will provide all the nutrients that we need for our life. But we must grab these nutrients. We've got to be like that plant that's trying to stretch those roots out and get every little bit of water that it can, every place it can find a little seam of water. It's going to put those roots there because it knows it needs it to live. We must grab the nutrients. And Peter laid a boatload in front of us right here. 2 Peter 1:5 through 8. "Besides this, giving all diligence, add," it's this growth process, "add to your faith virtue, to virtue knowledge, to knowledge temperance, temperance patience, patience godliness, godliness brotherly kindness charity." Those are fruits, Christian fruits. "For if these things be in you and abound, they make you," I'll underline the whole rest of it, but it would have been too red. They make you that you shall be neither barren nor unfruitful in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. So that we cannot be the barren fig tree if we will grab these nutrients. But we must go in the right direction. I love this one. Y'all got to love this one too. 1 Peter 3:10-11. This is the right direction. "He that will love life and see good days." Love life and see good days. Isn't that sweet? That just sounds good. "Let him refrain his tongue from evil, and his lips that they speak no guile." That's the unproductive. That's what we're trying to dig up. That's the weeds that we're trying to dig up. Let him eschew evil or hate. Let him hate evil and do good. That's a good fruit. Let him seek peace and ensue it. Okay? Let me catch up here. Seek peace and ensue it. We must bear fruit first in ourselves, then in others. Galatians 5:22, and you knew I was going to get this one before we got through. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. And they that are Christ have crucified the flesh with the affections and lust. Okay, so on one hand, we've got the fruit we're going to bear. On the other hand, we're talking about the crucifixion, which is a mortification, which is a deadening, which is digging up, which is getting these thoughts that we don't need to spend time on that's unproductive out of our schedule. See, get them out of our schedule for the day. I don't have time to think about those things. Then, when we do all this, our fruit is certainly for others to enjoy. As Paul said in Corinthians, charity suffers long and is kind. Charity envies not. Charity vaunts not itself, is not puffed up, does not behave itself unseemly, seeks not her own, is not easily provoked, thinks no evil, rejoices not in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. If I could snap my fingers and produce in every one of you a heart that would 100% of the time from now till you die, 100% of the time, you would be conscious of these 15 things in every relationship you've got, I would do it. I'm not saying you're bad, but I know human nature. And these 15 things are tough. I mean, these 15 things are tough. There's one right here that kills us. It's the one that says, bears all things. And that word is B-E-A-R, all things, not B-A-R-E, all things. That means cover up for the other person. Don't uncover other person's faults just because you can, just because you know something. But you keep it covered because you know something. For dunging to be successful, there must be an aha moment. Okay? We're winding this thing down. But now remember, this is a parable about change. This isn't a parable about status quo. This is a parable about change. We talked about awe. We talked about digging up the unproductive behaviors. We talked about the dunging, where we can find the nutrients of what we need to grow for. Throw one more thing out. What about an aha moment? When we finally realize what we're doing, we must dig up the weeds so that we can come to our senses. We had the prodigal son the other night, yesterday, and it was good. We're going to go back to it. This one verse, this one phrase is awesome. Luke 15, verse 17. When he came to himself, he said, how many hired servants of my father's have bread enough and to spare, and I perish with hunger? That was his aha moment when he realized, hey, I've been doing this all wrong, and there's a way I can do it right. I'm going to quit this stuff I've been doing, and I'm going to go to what is going to be better for me. I'm saying this was his aha moment when he came to himself. And this is what I wish for each one of you. If you haven't done it, that it will come to you very soon. Like the Word in me, I've used this one before, and I'll go over it real quickly. 1 Peter 1:17 through 19. My 82-year-old father, if you think you're getting too old to do anything, my 82-year-old father shamed me into beginning to memorize the Scriptures. To memorize and meditate on the Scriptures. And I'm slow at memorizing. Terribly slow. Because I'm not interested in just remembering to put one word after another and pass a quiz. I want to understand. I want to understand the concept. I want to understand the thought. I am very slow. This one passage right here. I've spent a few weeks on, okay? On this one thing. I'm serious. And then all of a sudden, one day, the light came on. I'd never experienced this before about just staying on one passage. Just stay on it, hammer on it, think about it, roll it over. If you call on the Father, who without respect of persons judges according to every man's work, pass the time of your sojourning here in fear. For as much as you know, you were not redeemed with corruptible things as silver and gold from your vain conversation received by tradition from your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. And if we can get to that conclusion in our heart, that when we do wrong, it's not just that we're going to get caught doing wrong or it's just not right. When we do wrong, we realize it's Jesus Christ's blood I'm shaming that gave His life for me. This is why I live in fear, so that I don't mess up and shame His name. How many church controversies would just fly out the window? How many marriages, marriage question, problems about people couldn't get along would just fly out the window? If they'd be non-existent if people had this passage in their heart and they lived in the fear of Jesus Christ. This is a huge aha moment for me right here. And I hope that it would be for you. Okay, so let's get down to the end. Cutting down the tree was the last resort. You got that, didn't you? Cutting down the tree. The keeper wanted to bear with it one more year. Cutting down the tree is the last resort. So, would God cut down the tree? Well, if we say this parable, it's got to do with Israel. We know the Lord let the Romans come in and cut the tree down of the political nation of Israel. We know that happened. But if this applies to us, what would be the equivalent of cutting down the tree? Of just getting it out of the way? Well, it could be that the Lord will look no more for fruit. He won't pay any attention to us anymore. Now, this is one verse out of a long passage. If you want to read it, it's an awesome passage about people and sinfulness. But in Romans 1:28, he says, "As even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind to do those things which are not convenient." I want you to zero in on that phrase, "gave them over to a reprobate mind." If you look in the Scriptures, there's many places. I just had a lesson on this and it just kind of fell right here about the phrase in the Bible where the blind man, the ex-blind man, said, "Now we know that God hears not sinners." Jesus didn't say that. That was the blind man that said that. But Jesus didn't refute it, so we know there must be some truth to it, because He refuted about everything else that was false and wrong. All right. Now, when you think about God hearing not sinners, does that mean He doesn't hear, or does that mean He doesn't respond? And if you go back in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, you can easily find, I found 10, but there's more than that. You can easily find examples of when God did not hear people. And He told them, if you go and sin, if you go this way, if you do this, I will not hear your prayer. You can offer up a sacrifice to me, I will accept it. You can offer a prayer, I'll turn my face away. I will not hear your prayer. Well, that doesn't mean He didn't hear. It means I'm not going to respond to it. I'm not going to accept it. I'm not going to give you what you wanted. Okay. Romans 1:28. These people were so bad that God says, "I'm going to give them up to a reprobate or a impure mind." That's the way they want to live. That's it. I'll not look for fruit on them anymore. Now, there's other things that could mean cutting down, and I'm not saying this is the best. I'm just saying this is the one that came to me. People that were cut down would be people that God gave up to a reprobate mind. So, here's the lesson. avoiding the tickle, you've been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Does God still look for fruit from His people? Why, sure. Because fruit is the best proof of heredity. If we say we're a child of God, how are we going to prove it? By the fruit that we bear. By our attitude, by our countenance, by how we present ourselves. Is He looking at me now? Yes. And the worst part is, not only is He looking at you, but He knows what you can do. He knows whether you're the five-talent man, or the two-talent man, or the one-talent man. He knows. And He knows what you're doing with those talents. He knows if you're the five-talent man and you're only playing around with one of them and the other four are buried. He knows. Is it too late for me to be productive? Never. Never. But our potential is declining daily. Declining daily. Look at me. All right. Losing my hair. White haired. I'm getting older. How many more years is anybody going to listen to me? I haven't got 50 more years in the Lord's service. I may not have 10 years that I would be considered relevant. You'll quit using me as a speaker here because I'm getting too old. That's just life. That's the way it goes. Our potential is declining daily. The Lord is looking at us to be fruitful. And He knows how fruitful we can be. So, with these few thoughts, this is my thoughts on the barren fig tree.